happiness needs to be geared to your brain, not this sort of cluster of happiness strategies like novelty. Knowing your brain type, and we tell people how to do that, and what makes you uniquely happy is really where I start.
Well, hey everybody, Dr. David Perlmutter here, and I have a question for you. That question is, who doesn't want to be happier? There's a new book out by my good friend Dr. Dan Amen called You Happier, and it targets what we need to be doing to actually achieve a better state of happiness. What Dr. Amen has discovered, which I think is really quite fascinating, is that the program to regain happiness or to increase happiness is actually quite specific. It's kind of like personalized medicine for regaining happiness. And he does that based upon certain questionnaires, certain information, and information that he has gleaned from reviewing hundreds of thousands of SPECT scans of his various patients, really coming to see him from around the world. The book is really quite fascinating, and he talks about increasing our happiness by 20% in 30 days. I'm all in. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Dan Amen. Daniel Amen's mission is to end mental illness by creating a revolution in brain health. He is dedicated to providing the education and services to accomplish this goal. He is a physician, an adult and child psychiatrist, and founder of the Amen Clinics with 10 locations now across the United States. Amen Clinics has the world's largest database of brain scans for psychiatry, totaling more than 200,000 SPECT scans on patients from 155 countries. He has produced 16 very successful national public television programs about the brain, and his online videos on brain and mental health have been viewed more than 300 million times. He is a 12-time New York Times bestselling author, including Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, The End of Mental Illness, Healing ADD, and many more. The new book is called You Happier, and I'm delighted to have Dr. Amen back on our program. Well, hello, Dr. Daniel Amen. Welcome to the program.
David, so great to see you. I hope we get to see each other in person soon.
Well, you know, you have a place in Florida now. You're opening a clinic here, so I'm all in. I'm there. I mean, let's make it happen for sure. And I will also tell you, our ping pong table remains set up in the garage waiting for you and your wife.
I love it.
We're getting pretty good, so I hope you guys are practicing.
Well, it's my favorite cerebellar exercise. Did you know people who play racket sports live longer than everybody else?
I'm not surprised. I had an interview yesterday, and I said handedness, using two hands or engaging in a racket sport, a hand-eye kind of a sport, really helpful for the brain, and I am not surprised. Have you tried pickleball?
You know, not yet. I'm sort of excited about it.
Yeah, me too. So let's push each other to do that. Are we already interviewing? You bet we are. You have a new book, You Happier. I started my intro that talking about who wouldn't want to be happier, and what a great goal to write a book about. That's super. It's a little nervy to do that, but congratulations.
Well, I decided, you know, when you write a book, you live with the topic for months and then years as you nurture the book. And it's like Americans are the unhappiest they have been since the Great Depression. And yeah. Early in the pandemic, I lost my dad. I had to close our Manhattan clinic for a couple of weeks. And I'm like, this is awful. How can I be happier, and how can I help the people I serve be happier too? And it was a hoot. I love this book, and I loved writing it, and I talk about it all the time in meetings with my staff. This morning, I'm like, who's got a micro moment of happiness? And one of my employees lives in Maine, and she said, I saw a bald eagle this morning. walking my dog. And just
the bald eagle was walking her dog. I'd love to see that.
She saw bald eagle while she was walking her dog. And just beginning to pay attention to what makes you happy is just one of, you know, dozens of tiny habits or small things people can do to make a big difference in how they feel.
What is really interesting about your book is that, if I may, you take a personalized medicine approach to giving an individual tools to become happier. I mean, you actually are able, via the questions that you ask and even with brain scanning, to determine how to cultivate a program that's unique for each individual to help him or her gain more happiness, gain a better appreciation of life. So that's kind of, you know, it kind of challenges the notion of don't worry, be happy, that if you just do these things, everyone, it's going to, one size fits all, everyone's going to be happier if they adopt certain things. So how does the brain scanning that you are so deeply involved in factor into that?
You know, we just went over 200,000 scans. And early on, when I started looking at the brain, I'm like, oh, depression's not one thing. ADD is not one thing. Obesity, addiction, they're not one thing in the brain, that they all have multiple types. And the types tended to go along with personality types. And as I was thinking about happiness, it's like some people jumping out of an airplane. Well, that makes them happy. Where for me, it would make me unhappy. I would be terrified. And what I did in the book, in fact, we even put it in the subtitle, based on your brain type, it's happiness needs to be geared to your brain. Not this sort of cluster of happiness strategies like novelty, which is great for the spontaneous person, the person who tends to have sleepy frontal lobes. It's a disaster for the persistent people whose frontal lobes tend to work too hard. And so knowing your brain type, and we tell people how to do that, and what makes you uniquely happy is really where I start in the book.
That's a very unique approach. I don't think anyone's ever done that. I mean, when you read books about becoming 10% happier via meditation, Dan Harris' book, or other books written about ways of becoming happier, it's just sort of the global recommendation. And now you've taken it to a personalized approach. You know, one of the things that you call out in the book that gets in people's way of achieving a higher level of happiness is the noise in their heads that I guess we all have to some degree. So let's define what that means, first of all, and then what do you do about it?
So the book is based on these 7 neuroscience secrets. So I tried to write about the things people aren't talking about. And secret number 5 is master your mind and gain psychological distance from the noise in your head. You know, there's nowhere in school where the system teaches kids to manage their minds. And we're left in a society of really undisciplined thinkers. But there's a neuroscience to mastering your mind. And in that section, I teach people to kill the ants, the automatic negative thoughts, which I've written about before. But for the first time, I wrote about this technique I just love called give your mind a name. That there's research that shows if you can gain psychological distance from the chatter in your head, you're happier. And you don't take yourself so seriously. And you can choose. I don't know if you were good at talking back to your parents when you were a teenager. I was excellent at it.
Excellent at what?
At talking back to my parents.
Oh, let me just tell you, as far as being a teenager, you have a raccoon in the book. I'm looking at it right now. It said, "I'm bored. Let's cause some trouble." And I made it. I copied that. I have it here on my desk because that's who I was. So, and anyone who knows me from my earlier years knows what I'm talking about. That's for darn sure. My middle initial was OOC because that stood for out of control. But anyway, we'll talk about that yet another day. So talking back to our parents, go ahead.
But no one ever taught me to talk back to myself, that I don't have to believe the nonsense or the noise that goes through my head. It's just sort of like the weather. So when I was interviewing Dr. Stephen Hayes, a psychologist who created a form of therapy called ACT, and he floated this idea of giving your mind a name. I'm like, well, what name would I give my mind? And it came to me almost instantly. I would name it after the pet raccoon I had when I was 16. Her name was Hermie, because I thought she was a boy. But anyways, I loved her, but she was a troublemaker. She TP'd my mother's bathroom. She ate all the fish out of my sister's aquarium. She would leave raccoon poo around the house. And I'm like, this is my mind. It's a troublemaker. And so metaphorically, if you name your mind, you can choose whether or not to listen to it, like you choose whether or not to listen to your spouse or whether or not to listen to your boss or whether or not to listen to anybody. And that separation helps you be happier.
I like that an awful lot, because I think we're all involved in that inner dialogue day in and day out, and self-criticism and being, you know, really kind of, some people more than others are kind of aggressively hard on ourselves in terms of the demands that we place on ourselves based upon, I think, you know, what we can consider to be the goals imparted in our brains from our upbringing. I mean, I'm 67, and I know that I wouldn't say suffer from it, but I'm still very much aware of it, you know, in terms of achievement. We are led to believe that we will be happier today if we have more of things, more objects, money, more this and that. Why is that leading us down the wrong path?
Well, in the book, I actually start with the lies of happiness. And the first lie is more of something will make you happy. That when you get something good, when you get something exciting, your brain produces a little bit of dopamine. It works on the nucleus accumbens, part of the basal ganglia in the brain, and you feel it. You like it, sort of like a little bit of cocaine. But the more you do it, the more it begins to wear out those cells in your brain. And pretty soon you begin to feel nothing at all. And so more and more. I just listened to Will Smith's autobiography, and it was great. And he described it perfectly, that, you know, from historic openings to his movies like Men in Black, pretty soon he just didn't feel it, and he had to do more and more. And I've been blessed to see some historic performers, Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, you know, I just adore them. But you see how fame wears out the pleasure centers in their brain. And pretty soon they're using drugs not to feel good, but to stop feeling bad. And you have to protect your pleasure centers and really wrestle with the lie that more, and, you know, both you and I have had national bestsellers, and it's like, well, once you have one, well, then you have to have another one. And then it has to be a number one New York Times bestseller. And you just see the lie of it all, because ultimately we became healers to help people get well. And that's ultimately what makes us happy. But you can get caught up in that treadmill.
No question. I mean, the example you give the example of Mick Jagger, I can't get no satisfaction. In terms of, you know, his sexual exploits, what was it, 6,000 or 7,000 women that he claims to have bedded? But it's true. The more you do something, the more you think you need to do it. In a more general way, though, you do spend a little time in the book, a fair amount of time, talking about how to be happier in general, we have to have overall a healthier brain. That a healthier brain ultimately can translate to a brain that allows us to be happier. So what are some of the recommendations just for everyone, without being specific then, that makes for a healthier, therefore a happier brain?
So I did a study for this book on 500 consecutive patients. We gave them the Oxford Happiness Questionnaire. And then we studied their scans and compared the people with the highest level of happiness and those with the lowest. And it was really clear. If you have low blood flow to your frontal lobes, you're much more likely to be unhappy. And in the book, I talk about my Bright Minds mnemonic. You want to keep your brain healthy or rescue it. If it's headed to the dark place, you have to prevent or treat the 11 major risk factors that steal your mind. And I think there's really a good consensus around what damages your brain. But blood flow, you want to be happier. Avoid things that damage blood flow, caffeine, nicotine, hypertension, heart disease, being sedentary, and engage in habits that increase blood flow. So we talked about, before we went on, we talked about exercise, especially coordination exercise increases blood flow. Ginkgo, beets, oregano, cayenne pepper, rosemary, cinnamon, all of those things can increase blood flow to the brain. And never let a child hit a soccer ball with their head. Of like, are we insane? Brain is soft, skull is hard, skull has sharp bony ridges. Mild traumatic brain injury is a major cause of depression. I did the big NFL study when the NFL was sort of lying, they had a problem. I've scanned and treated 300 NFL players. Our group had four times the level of depression than what is in the general population. I mean, that's just horrifying when you think about it. So protect your brain and do what you can to increase blood flow.
You know, one of the things that's been interesting to me as of late, and you and I actually talked about this yesterday, wasn't it yesterday that we had our conversation? I think so. And it is the incredible role that uric acid elevation plays in compromising blood flow to all of our organs, including the brain. When uric acid is elevated, it inhibits nitric oxide. Therefore, it inhibits vasodilatation, the ability of blood vessels to open up and supply blood to our vital organs, the brain, the kidney, the heart, the liver, etc. That's really one of the big reasons that there is such an increased risk of death from stroke, as well as Alzheimer's disease, I might add, in people with elevated uric acid. So we are all over that. As we talk about the morphology, or what the brain looks like on these brain scans, you had an interesting figure in the book, which is your brain scan, I think, at age 37, and then your brain scan at age 62. And I'd like to put that image up right now. And if you can, tell us what we're seeing on the left side in the Dr. Dan Amen's brain at age 37, and then move to the right side and how it's changed when you've turned 62.
So a healthy scan shows full, even, symmetrical activity. And the week before I did mine, I did my 60-year-old mother's scan, and she had a beautiful brain. I mean, it was stunning. It's one of the best brains I'd ever seen. And then my scan looks shriveled. And I'm like, why does my brain look so bad? I had played football in high school. I had meningitis twice when I was a young soldier. And I had a lot of bad habits, like I didn't sleep more than 4 hours a night. I was overweight. I ate a lot of bad food. So here I am. It's 1991. I'm a double board certified psychiatrist. I was the top neuroscience student in medical school, but I don't care about my own brain because I had never seen it. And, you know, I joke, I created brain envy you know, compared to my mom, I wanted her brain. Freud was wrong. Penis envy is not the cause of anybody's problem. Haven't seen it once in 40 years. But I fell in love with my brain, and I'm like, no, I wanted better, which really put me on this journey of being a brain health warrior. You know, and every day, and one of the questions I ask in the book is, this good for my brain or bad for it? Because if it's bad for my brain, I don't do it. Why? Because I love myself and I have brain envy. And so I've scanned myself periodically throughout the years. And when I was 62, my brain looked younger, fuller, fatter, healthier, which is really the core message of my life. You are not stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better, and I can prove it. And with a better brain, because of blood flow, SPECT is a blood flow study, your sex life is better. Why? Because if you have blood flow problems anywhere, they're everywhere. And you probably found with uric acid that also increased
38% increased risk of erectile dysfunction.
Right. And if you have erectile dysfunction, it means you have brain dysfunction. Because if you have blood flow problems anywhere, they're everywhere. And you've probably noticed this as well. When people get on a brain health program, their erections are better and they're happier.
Yeah. And I would say that I had this discussion yesterday on an interview, and that is that, you know, it's kind of silly to think that there could be a heart healthy program that would be different from a brain healthy program, that would be different from a general metabolically better health program. That there are a core set of things that are good for the body and therefore good for the brain, as if it were distant from the body. And, you know, ultimately, everybody you talk to who are specialists in one area or another, who are leading edge and understanding the impact of lifestyle, pretty much everybody's saying the same thing. We've got to target blood flow. We've got to target inflammation. We've got to target oxidative stress, or the damaging action of free radicals. And we've got to keep metabolism in check. We've got to keep blood sugar and blood pressure in check. Everybody, no matter what the specialty, is basically saying the same thing.
No, I think that's absolutely correct. And if we added stress reduction, that would just help people so much, because not knowing how to manage your mind is so damaging to every organ in the body. And secret number six, I love a lot. Notice what you like about other people more than what you don't. Because when you give happiness away, you are much happier. And I totally have an impact on Tana's level of happiness. That if I'm kind, if I'm thoughtful, if I notice what I like more than what I don't, we just have such a better relationship than if I'm a jerk. And so being focused not only on what makes me happy, but what makes others around me happy, noticing what I like more than what I don't, just makes your heart better. It makes your kidneys better. It makes everything better.
Well, let's move on to number seven then, which is having defined values, purpose, and goals. And you know, it seems like these days, no one's really thinking about that. And yet you bring it up as being such a key for achieving happiness. And I would submit having a better functioning brain, or maybe vice versa.
Well, they go together. You know, if you have sleepy frontal lobes, one of the very first things I'll have you do is the exercise in the book called the One Page Miracle. On one piece of paper, I want you to write down what you want. Because our spontaneous group, they're more impulsive, they're more creative, they're more live in the moment. But I want you to feel better now and later versus now, but not later. And so being very clear, and I'm shocked, you know, I've been doing this like you for 40 years, and very few of my patients actually have any idea what they really want in their lives. When you ask them, they'll talk about money or work. But it's like, no, no, no. You need to define what you want. You need to tell your brain what you want, because your brain is special. And, but in a balanced way, what do you want in your relationships, work, money, physical, emotional, spiritual health? What do you want? And then every day you post this and you just go, it's my behavior getting me what I want. I think, you know, if I look back on my career and go, you know, so why have you been successful? It's not just hard work, right? There are a lot of people that work harder than I do. I mean, I would argue the people in the grocery store, my dad owned a chain of grocery stores, they actually work harder than I do, but I'm focused in what I do based on what I want in all of those areas. Because if you just focus on work, your life becomes unbalanced and you become burnt out, which is why I love the four circles of health that I talk about in the book. And what you want is really based on your values. So like at Amen Clinics, we have core values, authenticity. We live the message of brain health. We're science-based. We're outcome-driven. And ownership, I created an employee stock option program for us. So I want everybody to be aligned. And so I talk about core values all the time. But what is your, what are your personal core values? And do you live it out? And I think that contributes to happiness because you're just much more effective in your life, and being successful clearly is associated with happiness.
Well, I'm trying. As I hear you speak, I think, am I trying hard enough? But I'm trying. I think the central tenet of the book is that cultivating a happiness program really depends on your brain type. Does a person necessarily need a SPECT scan to understand their brain type?
No. There's a link in the book on for free, how can you know your brain type? There's five primary types: balanced, which means you're focused and flexible and positive and generally relaxed; spontaneous, where you're a bit impulsive but creative and out of the box thinker, you love surprises; persistent, your frontal lobes work really hard, you accomplish what you set out to, but you could also worry and hold grudges and things don't go your way, you get upset and you hate surprises; sensitive, you need connection, you're deeply empathic. The pandemic was hard on that group. And cautious, jumping out of an airplane, never going to happen. The cautious type are, you know, they like peace, they like quiet, they like a warm bath and lavender and soft music. And you can have combinations of these types, but knowing your type, then you can ask yourself every day, am I doing things that make me uniquely happy?
Based upon my type, am I catering, full understanding this is who I am, now that I get that, am I catering to that definition of who I am?
Right, because so many people think, oh, societally, I should want this, but I don't want it. And so it ends up to be an internal conflict. And if you just go, you know, maybe that's just how you're wired. And does it make you happy? And if it doesn't, then, you know, why do it? Try to get rid of the
societal perspective. We get an awful lot of pressure about, trying to convince us of what we should want and therefore what we should get, you know, whether it's the latest technology or more money, a car, whatever it may be, you know, we're kind of convinced that getting those things, society tends to, you know, more, I guess it's more advertising and social pressure to make those our goals.
Right. And, you know, we base our success on the idea of what other people might think. And for me, that's just a trap. You know, I want to base my success on, well, what are my values? What's my purpose? What's my goals? I had a fight recently with NPR. They tried to take my head off. And I just, you know, when I thought about it, I'm like, you know, I've changed more people's lives than you've ever thought about. So that's what makes me happy, not what other people think of me. And you know this, when you're a pioneer, when you're trying to do something different, it brings out a lot of haters. So if you don't have
it, does. And you know what? It's okay. One of the most, I think, instructional events in my life was somebody wanted to write a book telling us that, telling people that gluten was really a good thing, we should eat more of it. And he wrote an article in a national magazine about how terrible Dr. Perlmutter is. 3 or 4 pages just of stuff that was just, I don't know where he dreamed it up, about what an awful person I am. And it was published online. The next morning, I had this interventional call with my publicist and my agent, and everybody got on the phone and said, Dr. Perlmutter, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You know, how are we going to counter this? And I said, I don't know. I just said, God bless him. Because I realized this is his gambit. This is the best he can do to engage me and start this imbroglio to bring, you know, recognition to himself. It's still there. It's still front and center when you Google me. And it's been a really good lesson. You know, if we don't elicit that response from people, we're not working hard enough. We are now status quo, and that's not a place for Dan Amen. It's never been a place for David Perlmutter either, because status quo, according to Ronald Reagan, is a Latin term for the mess we're in. And you know, our mission is to look into, to see what we can do to improve the situation. It's what your new book is about. You know, a very fresh new perspective on this whole notion of happiness, however you want to define it. We talked about this offline a moment ago, and that is that your scans and your research has come to a conclusion that the cerebellum, the little brain, the back part of the brain that, you know, classically we have associated with coordinated movement activity, but you're finding that the cerebellum, based upon reviewing scans, may be playing a role in our happiness. What did you learn?
Well, the cerebellum is the Rodney Dangerfield part of the brain. Now, I hate that because the young students I teach have no idea who Rodney Dangerfield
was. About getting
was.
No respect.
Yeah, he was a great comedian.
Caddyshack.
And I mean, so many great bits he had. I love him. But, you know, his big thing was I get no respect. So the cerebellum's 10% of the brain's volume, but it has half the brain's neurons, and it's virtually connected to every other part of the brain, but especially the prefrontal cortex. In fact, if you damage the left side of your prefrontal cortex, it'll actually turn off the right side of your cerebellum. It's fascinating. And it's involved in coordination, but also thought coordination. How quickly you can integrate new information. And when the cerebellum's low, you get confused and you have trouble thinking. You also have trouble with coordination. And there's this group of studies, in fact, I was just reviewing them this morning, on how gluten deactivates the cerebellum. And so when people go, oh, gluten, you only have to avoid it if you have celiac. It's like, I think if I was a high performance athlete, I'd avoid it all the time, but especially on game day.
Well, you could talk to Djokovic about that. He would tell you. But, you know, you're right. The relationship of gluten to cerebellar functionality has been something described for an awful long time. I remember in medical school, in histology, we were looking at the neurons in the cerebellum. And I remember they were very, very tall and had little branches. And the instructor said to me, passing by, said, that is the arbor vitae. the tree of life, because it looked like a tree, and I've never forget that. That just it just struck me, a tree growing, you know, in the cerebellum. And I will admit, in the neurosurgery years, that if we needed to get to some lesion, a tumor perhaps in the back of the head, we would sacrifice the cerebellum, basically with the thought being, well, it's not really that important. People regain their ability to carry out coordinated activity even without part of their cerebellum. I mean, how important can it be? So, you know, there's a bit of revelation then in your finding and your recapitulating the work of others that you know, there's other things going on in that cerebellum as it relates, for example, to the prefrontal cortex.
You know, I published a study on 1,000 autistic kids, and low cerebellar activity, very common, especially in an area called the cerebellar vermis. We also see it low in ADHD, low in learning disabilities, very common low in frontal traumatic brain injuries. It's a fascinating term called cerebellar diaschisis, mm-hmm. where if you hurt one side of the brain, it turns off the opposite side.
So, right, you were describing that earlier.
And this is why it's so important to engage in regular coordination exercises. So when they would limit PE in school, kids would have more trouble learning and thinking. And so I just want them to do exercises they don't get concussions.
You're right. You know, I interviewed Jim Quick recently, and he was saying, yeah, you know, in school, it's all about what you learn, not how you learn. And there's really no emphasis on the techniques that build a better brain in terms of targeting its maturation process, its learning capacity. So you are opening a new clinic in Florida, I'm told.
Hollywood, Florida. It's now open.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to go. I'm going there actually tonight to give a talk, but I'm ready to get my brain scanned. So maybe that's something we'll do, and we can maybe even, who knows, maybe do it live. I'd be willing to do that, see what we find, hoping there's something up there.
Well, I'm sure it is, given how consistent and smart and hardworking you are. You know, but when you see your brain, David, it's never the same afterwards. Like, and you always think about the decisions you make, but you begin to fall in love and you have a relationship with your brain. I'm doing this series on Instagram called Scan My Brain. And we're taking influencers who, you know, they have a significant community, and I'm seeing them and we're scanning them, and then we talk about it. And we just published Troy Gloss. So Troy was the 2002 World Series MVP. He hit 320 home runs over his career. I mean, he's just an amazing baseball player. But he was drinking too much, and he was sad, and he'd had 4 concussions, and his brain looked awful. But he just did everything I asked him to do. Stopped drinking, exercised more, lost 15 pounds, ate right, took his supplements, which we haven't talked about yet. And I scanned him 2 months later. His brain's dramatically better. And I just love that so much for him. So he saw it. He realized some of his behaviors were not brain friendly, stopped them, engaged in the program. And as his brain got better, his relationship with his son got better. Mm, his relationship with his
story.
Wife got better. And that's why looking is so important, because you can't really change what you don't measure. So I'm thrilled when you do it. Let me know. I would.
Well, I'll definitely want you to be there. So we'll coordinate this. We'll see how the schedule looks over the next few months. Well, anyway, I want to wish you luck. What a treat that I got to spend 2 days with you. I'm very honored. We did yesterday and today. And I know this is going to be a very, very impactful book. And you have a PBS special coming out on based on this book?
I do.
Oh, I saw that.
Starting soon. And you have one on your new book, Drop Acid?
I do.
So that'll be fun. I wish you all the best with it. I ordered a uric acid monitor, and I'm going to start talking about that as well.
Oh, good. Well, it's all about nitric oxide and brain blood flow. But I did send a monitor to your home in California, or maybe your office. I'm not actually. I didn't send it. My team did. But there you go. Well, I want to say thank you for joining us today and spending time with all of our viewers, because it's always so meaningful. And I don't know how many of these we've done together, but every time it feels like it's brand new. So thanks.
Thank you, my friend. I miss you, and I hope I get to see you soon. And your brain.
It'll happen. I'm heading over to Hollywood. We're going to make it happen. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Thanks, David.
Bye-bye. Well, again, our goal should be one of our goals to become happier. And I think Dr. Amen really nails it with this new book. I had the opportunity to look at this book, review it, and there's some wonderful information that's really very, very empowering for each of us to achieve our goal to become happier people. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter. Thanks for joining me today, and I'll be back soon. Bye for now.